And hello again, I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm speaking with Kimberly Martin, who's a political science professor at Barnard College, Columbia University. She's finishing a book on warlords and sovereignty, with one chapter focusing on Ramzan Kadyrov in Chechnya and his relationship with the Russian state. Her books include Enforcing the Peace, Learning from the Imperial Past, Weapons, Culture, and Self-Interest, Soviet Defense Managers in the New Russia, and Engaging the Enemy, Organization Theory and Soviet Military Innovations. Thank you for joining us here today, Kimberly Martin.
Thank you for inviting me.
And it's difficult to figure out who the perpetrators of this bombing at Moscow airport might be, although the security services in Russia say that they were tipped off a week ago that terrorist attacks were planned. Why they were unable to prevent it is another matter. But there have been in the past, there's kind of a murky nexus between former KGB officers, politicians, oligarchs, and warlords. And still many people believe that the previous bombings attributed to terrorists had state fingerprints on them, going back to the emergence of Putin and the beginning of the Second Chechen War. Has that led you to have any kind of suspicion in this regard? I mean, is that something we should have in the back of our mind?
No, I don't think so. I think they're two separate things that have to be kept separate. The bombings that originally happened in 1999, that were the apartment bombings that happened in Moscow and other Russian cities, those cases were ones where there was never a good investigation. They were blamed on separatists from the North Caucasus, but there are a lot of people, including a lot of very level-headed Western experts, who believe that the whole story has not been told there. And so in that case in 1999, we might have that suspicion. But since 2002, there have been a series of horrific attacks that have clearly been carried out by people who are from the North Caucasus. And so the latest attacks today actually fall into this pattern that has been happening for the last decade.
And, of course, there was the train, the St. Petersburg train in 2004. Two suicide bombers were able to board a plane at the very airport that was attacked yesterday and killing all 90 people on board. So we're certainly familiar with this. So what is the source of this? If, as you've profiled in your work, Kimberly Martin, the strongman down there in Chechnya is supposed to be keeping a lid on this, but clearly he's not.
Right. It has not been very effective at all. In the North Caucasus in 2010, the latest figures indicate that there were actually 1,700 deaths from political violence. And so a lot of that obviously doesn't get reported in the international media, but the problems in the North Caucasus are far from solved. And I think the truth is that experts don't really have a clear sense of why terrorist attacks happen. There is a lot of disagreement among people. A lot of different scholars have different perspectives on things. But I think what we need to pay attention to is the question of what motivates the leaders of the groups, what motivates the people who are actually willing to commit suicide in these attacks, and then the question also of what motivates the broader society in the North Caucasus to tolerate this, to give shelter to people who commit these kinds of acts, rather than, for example, working with the police to make sure that they don't happen. And so I think there are three different things that we have to look at. In terms of what motivates the leaders, it's hard to know because there is a particular Islamist leader who takes credit, if you want to use that term, for all of these terrorist attacks, even when it does not appear that he is directly involved. And so just because even we know that someone from the North Caucasus has committed the attack, we don't necessarily know how tightly connected that is to a major group, how hierarchical the group is, or how much it is individual people who are motivated for various reasons going off on their own in the name of Islamism. It does appear that in this case, the attack was timed to try to embarrass President Medvedev as he was about to go to the major meeting of international business leaders in Davos, Switzerland. And certainly the fact that this attack happened at the international arrivals area for the major airport in Moscow that is the connector for European flights and flights coming in from London indicates that the effort in this case was designed to have an effect on Russia's international relations. That has not so much happened before. The attacks previously have been mostly oriented towards either ordinary people, for example, with the subway attacks, or towards the elite, the train that was hit going between Moscow and St. Petersburg was sort of equivalent to the Acela train that goes back and forth between Washington and New York that would be carrying people who are in the business world. So this is the first one that's really attacked an international audience, and it's probably not accidental in the timing as well, because Russia is preparing to hold the Olympics in 2014 in Sochi, which is a city located just outside of the North Caucasus area. And this was probably in part designed to try to make people feel as if they would be insecure if they attended the Olympics. So that's one set of issues. And the second set of issues that's very important is why people in the North Caucasus continue to tolerate this. And I think the answer behind that is that there is a complete lack of trust of the Russian authorities. The Russian police are known to be corrupt and to be very brutal. And there is also a sense, especially we saw with the ethnic rioting that happened in December in Moscow, of people from the North Caucasus not being able to make their way in society. They are considered second-class citizens by the ethnic Russian population.
Yeah, the term that's commonly used is chunya, right, which is the equivalent of our N-word.
Yes, exactly. What that means is sometimes you hear people say, oh, the terrorism is because of economic reasons, that it's the poverty. Well, I don't think there are any experts who believe that terrorism is caused by poverty, because there's so many areas in the world that do have poverty that don't have terrorism. But instead, it's caused by hopelessness, by a desire for personal revenge, particularly for people who have had family members or close friends who have been treated badly by the Russian state or killed by the police. And it's also often done for reasons of humiliation, that if people feel that they have been degraded, that makes them want to get back at the state for degrading them. And so all of those things go into explaining what happened.
And that explains the participation of the widows in a lot of these. So you don't believe, for example, that the nationalist killings, the Spartak soccer game, you know, which were blamed on the Chechens. I mean, they are discriminated against. The country's been ravaged in successive wars. I still go back to that question of what are the Russians thinking by putting a thug down there just to beat people into submission? Is there a carrot and a stick? It sounds like from day one they've only had a stick.
Well, what's very clear in Chechnya is that they tried an experiment with Ramzan Kadyrov in the belief that maybe that would control the problem in the Caucasus. Ramzan Kadyrov was originally the son of the first leader of Chechnya after the Second Civil War there, who had also been put in place by Moscow. He was not an obvious person to take over the position from his father because he was very young when his father was assassinated. And what I trace out in the chapter in my book is exactly how, starting in about 2003-2004, Ramzan Kadyrov was able to get legal control over all of the security forces on Chechen territory. And it was because at each stage along the way, in that time, President Putin, now Prime Minister Putin, worked with Ramzan Kadyrov to push him forward and to give his militia more control over what was happening on Chechen territory. So there's no question that Ramzan Kadyrov was put in place by the central administration in Moscow as a sort of experiment to see if a strongman controlling the territory could work. What Ramzan was very good at, he's still very good at, is using his security forces to convince people to come over to his side. And he does that by engaging in extremely brutal activities. He tortures people. He kills people. He kills family members. He threatens to kill family members. He burns down houses in an effort to try to coerce people into coming over to his side. And at this point, approximately half of the Chechen security forces are actually these people that Ramzan Kadyrov has managed to turn to his side through these very brutal techniques. But if you think about that, it also means that people are not supporting Ramzan Kadyrov because they think he's a wonderful person. It means that half of his security forces probably are supporting him because they didn't feel that they had any other alternative except supporting him.
And well, it's sort of a version of the Stockholm syndrome, isn't it?
Well, in some ways, I think that it probably is. But what that also means is that the Russian state does not have very good control over what is happening in Chechnya. A lot of experts believe that rather than controlling terrorism and the terrorist threat, what Putin has succeeded in doing is controlling Chechen separatism. He has made sure that now Chechnya will say that it's a part of Russia, but he actually doesn't have much control over the security situation there. Because Ramzan Kadyrov has so much control, it means that he controls all of the information about what's happening on the ground. There are very few Russian personnel who are not from Chechnya that are left on the ground to do any monitoring of the situation for Moscow. So effectively what it means is that Putin, and now Medvedev following him, have essentially given sovereignty over to Chechnya after fighting two very bloody, very expensive wars to try to keep Chechnya on Russian territory. They have sort of sovereignty in name, but de facto it's Ramzan Kadyrov and his militia that control Chechnya, and they don't control it very effectively.
Well, I've always understood, though, again, I'm speaking with Kimberly Mount, who's currently finishing a book that in part examines the relationship between Chechen warlords and the Russian state. I was always understood, Kimberly, that there's a subtext in terms of oil pipelines, and that you could use the old adage from the Eisenhower days about what's good for GM is good for America, what's good for Gazprom is good for Russia. And they clearly want to be able to control the pipelines that extract energy out of Russia. And the only one that operates is through Georgia. And, you know, they've had a war with Georgia. Just in a broad kind of macro sense, do you think this is a big factor here?
No, it's not. In the mid-1990s, you're right. When the first Chechen Civil War started, there was an oil issue that was associated with it, mm-hmm. because at that time there was a major pipeline that went through Chechen territory. After that first civil war, that pipeline was diverted. So there's no longer, at this point, a major pipeline that goes through Chechnya to the rest of Russia. There is some oil located on Chechen territory. It is a tiny fraction of the oil that's available on Russian territory as a whole. So it would be very surprising if that small amount of oil mattered all that much in Russian politics. And furthermore, there's no evidence that Ramzan Kadyrov would be somebody who did a better job of getting Putin's interest in the oil met in Chechnya than any other possible alternative would be. So there's no question Ramzan Kadyrov cooperates with Putin on oil issues in Chechnya. It's not really all that significant in terms of what's happening in Russia. And in fact, what has been happening recently, as Ramzan Kadyrov has been getting all of this power away from the central government in Moscow, is that he has pushed very hard to have Rosneft, a major state-owned oil company, which is often seen as a competitor to Gazprom, by the way, put a major oil refinery in Chechnya to replace one that shut down during the earlier civil wars. And after lobbying and lobbying and lobbying very publicly for this for a couple of years, finally, this past fall, the announcement was made that, in fact, this refinery will be built. And it's sort of an odd place to build a refinery because Chechen oil is running out. It's a very small amount of oil. All the experts believe that within about 15 years, it'll basically have been run dry. It's an old set of oil fields. And so it's an odd place to put a refinery. And if anything, it indicates that Ramzan Kadyrov is using oil to his advantage rather than that Putin is interested in Chechnya because of the oil.
Pretty clear. And I mean, nothing is clear, obviously, in post-Soviet Russia, or not that it was clear during the Soviet Union. But there are lots of rumors that Kadyrov is behind the assassination of Anna Politkovskaya, and others with the Novaya Gazeta, which is the only independent paper left in Russia. What would be the motives if this is true?
There is a very distressing tendency for any Russian citizen who delves too deeply into what Ramzan is doing to end up being assassinated. And so that includes people who are his political rivals within Chechnya, who might be a real challenge to his authority. And it also includes anybody who engages in muckraking, particularly on financial issues. So it's, you know, completely possible for somebody to criticize Ramzan and not to be in any danger. But people who go to Chechnya and try to do in-depth research and find out what's really going on and try to accuse him of corruption or financial wrongdoing do have a tendency to be murdered.
And an insider from the inner circle who ends up in Austria gets killed in the streets of Austria as well.
Right.
So just in closing then, I'm trying to understand here the broader future context of Russia's internal security problems and the notion of an Islamic threat within Russia, although the Islamic connection with Chechnya may be that murky because there's so much gangsterism and brutality. There's nevertheless a relatively small part of the Muslim parts of Russia. In Tatarstan, which is much closer to Moscow, I think it's about 15 million people there. So does Russia have, if it can't get a more subtle approach, shall we say, to dealing with these problems, does it have greater problems in the future?
Well, I think the thing to keep in mind is that Islam in the Russian space has always been a very different form of Islam than the Wahhabist extremist Islam that's associated with terrorism. And so the terrorists that follow that particular form, that very minority form of Islam, really don't fit very well in the North Caucasus for the most part, especially in Chechnya. There's some other areas where there's been a longer history of them fitting well. So I think the issue is really not so much religion. It's not so much Islam. It's an ethnic population that feels that it cannot get ahead no matter what it does, that has a desire to take revenge because of what Russia has done beforehand, and that doesn't trust the authorities and doesn't trust the police.
So it sort of reminds me of the Tolstoy short story, The Cossacks. Is this a cultural history that the Russians have always beaten up on these people?
We have to be careful of historical determinism, because there are some people who look at Chechnya as being wild and ungovernable because of Tolstoy's history. Mm-hmm. And the history indicates that that's not actually true. And so we have to be careful of not engaging in ethnic stereotyping about who the Chechen population is. But Ramzan Kadyrov actually used money from his foundation to restore a home in Chechnya that had been used by Tolstoy during his visits.
Well, I'm fascinated by this conversation, Kimberly. We've run out of time, so hopefully we can revisit it, and not necessarily under these circumstances, but clearly this is something to explore further. And I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I've been speaking with Kimberly Martin, who teaches political science at Barnard College at Columbia University. Her scholarship focuses on security issues in Russia and the former Soviet Union. She is finishing a book on warlords and sovereignty, with one chapter focusing on Ramzan Kadyrov in Chechnya and his relationship to the Russian state. We'll take a short break and return in a moment and talk with Jane Hampshire, who was just detained trying to visit Private Manning, who is accused of leaking the WikiLeaks.